The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
And joining me now is the Managing Director of Twitter Ireland and Vice President of Public Policy for Twitter in Europe, the Middle East and Africa, Sinead McSweeney. You're very welcome to the show.
Hi, Brendan. Good to be here.
Sinead, Managing Director of Twitter Ireland is self-explanatory. What does the Vice President of Public Policy in Europe, Middle East and Africa do?
So I lead a team across the region of people, I suppose, that you could best describe as Twitter's ambassadors to governments, to regulators, to legislators. So we have the conversations with government about regulations. We do the parliamentary hearings that you will sometimes see when social media are called to Parliament. But we also, as well as talking to all of these people, we are also the ears. We listen to all of these people and are often the vehicle by which Twitter gets information back to engineers and product designers about something that's not working or not working in the way in which we intended. So we have partnerships with lots and lots of different safety groups, human rights groups, to make sure that we are constantly evolving to meet new challenges as they emerge.
So it's an interesting job right now. It's an interesting place to be at that intersection between social media and society. And it's interesting you use the phrase things not working as they're supposed to.
Yeah.
Like you'd wonder sometimes, is Twitter working as it's supposed to or as it was intended to? Because I suppose you would accept that, like, we saw social media in the frame for the riots and the violence last week in Dublin, and it social media and Twitter are playing a big part in, I suppose, kind of amplifying rancor in the public discourse, and B, then in the straightforward spread of lies and misinformation, aren't they?
Twitter is an open public platform. So everything that's amazing and powerful about that fact that gave us Home to Vote and the Me Too movement and Bring Back Our Girls and all of these campaigns and activism also, of course, can be harnessed by bad actors for bad activities. So from our point of view, we see the power of the platform, and we know that that power also brings great responsibility. So, you know, in the context of what you mentioned specifically about the protests last week, I mean, we have policies designed to detect what we would call coordinated harmful activity. On the one hand, anything that's going to lead to offline harm, that's against our policies. Underlying all of that, and I suppose driving the protests separate from the actual call to action, is what you said about misinformation. And over the last year, we had already developed a misinformation policy directed towards elections, because that obviously is a huge concern if you have things like voter suppression or voter misinformation. But over the last year, we have also had to develop really robust policies around COVID misinformation, vaccine misinformation. And there are two
sides. But it's not working, is it?
It is working. We are removing hundreds and thousands of pieces of content from the platform. But also, in addition to that, there has to be a shift in the debate about online content that moves from a binary one of it either stays up or it comes down to looking at how is content amplified, how are algorithms working. And we often take an approach of downranking or de-amplifying bad content and promoting positive content. So in every single country in Europe, we have a relationship with the health authority, we have a relationship with the HSE here to ensure that when somebody searches for something about COVID-19, what they see is the verified information that we have from government/medical sources to stand that up.
Okay. I'm interested in a few things you say there. You say it's a public platform, and therefore I suppose you're saying a reflection of the good and bad in society. But I suppose, Sinead, it's not a public utility or a public good. So it's not all of our responsibility to control it. This is a private company where a lot of people got very, very rich from. So is it not your job to control that? It's not a societal issue, is it? It's an issue for Twitter.
It is our job. It is most definitely our job. It's our platform. We've seen the power of it, and we recognise the responsibility that comes with that. It is not in our interest to have a platform that doesn't feel safe or where people can't trust the information on it. It hurts individuals, it hurts our users, it hurts the community in which these conversations take place, and ultimately it hurts the company. So nobody at Twitter is sitting there going, let's see how much harm we can cause with this platform.
I believe that you care about it, but what I suppose what I'm asking as well is like can you control it? Like have you built something? Has this company built something that has this enormous impact that it can't control? I mean, you can't sit in front of me hand in heart, I know, and say that there isn't misinformation and rancor being propagated and facilitated on Twitter all the time, can you?
No, I can't say to you that it's not there all the time, but what I can say to you is through a combination of robust policies, changes within our product and investment in our enforcement, we are doing everything we can on a daily basis to manage that and control it. Do we always get it right? No, we don't. Are we always quick enough? No, we're not. But that doesn't take from the fact that we can't give up on the platform that has given us so much positivity, even in the context of COVID. If you look at the way people who were ended up isolated and living alone were able to stay connected, entertain each other, create, you know, social networks and connections that were deprived of them, we can't give all of that up because a small minority of people have decided to abuse the potential of the platform. And we as a company need to address ourselves to that. I don't accept that it is completely on us. We have a saying, what happens in the world happens on Twitter. That's generally talking about football games or natural disasters or elections. But it also means that behaviours within society which are becoming prevalent also are reflected on the platform. And we do have a problem in this country about how we now engage with each other and the level of anger, the level of rancor that has entered into political discourse, polite discourse. We've forgotten how to disagree about issues.
But again, it feels like you're kind of saying, well, this is a social issue and we just reflect it.
I'm absolutely not saying it's a social issue.
I think it's kind of as well that I come from an old media situation, right, where you had to spend a whole lot of money and a lot of resources thrown at not putting out anything that was irresponsible, that was fake, that might destroy someone's reputation, whatever. All these rules, you have to do that because it's your platform and you're responsible.
You do have
Whereas
to do
it seems like you're
of
kind
that.
Of saying, look, we do our best, but meh.
And you do all of that. And I spent 8 years working as a press officer in two police organisations. And I can give you endless examples where, despite all of those mechanisms within media, despite all of that commitment, things were printed which were absolutely incorrect. They were not just incorrect, but they hurt people.
And there's a mechanism there for people to get a lot of money from the courts to get huge
and those mechanisms
apologies
exist and all. For us as well. And actually, the whole discussion that's going on now right across Europe and here with the Online Harms Bill is directed to how do we find that balance between freedom of expression and safety? Because freedom of expression is meaningless if people don't feel safe or if they're silenced by others abusing their expression. But we have to find a system, and that we're working with government here, we're working in Brussels, to find that system that achieves that balance, that it's not just governments deciding what people can say online and it's not just companies deciding what people can say online.
Because it's interesting, the freedom of expression thing, right? There was a kind of an illustration of it there. I think it was on Claire Byrne the other night. Luke O'Neill was talking about young female scientists in the UK who are speaking in the media about COVID, about vaccines, about that kind of thing. And I think we all agree that science publicly has done an amazing job in over the last year in keeping us all informed and keeping us kind of maybe less anxious and whatever, right? He said that they are being abused horribly on Twitter, these young female scientists, and that the point of it is, as he sees it, is to stop them from talking out. So there's your two sides of freedom of speech. Somebody is free to do that, and you guys obviously can't stop everyone in time, and then that's impacting on other people's feeling of safety to speak out.
And that is a concern for us, and that is something that we have dedicated ourselves to, particularly in the last few years. I joined Twitter almost 9 years ago, where I think we seriously over-indexed to freedom of expression. Whereas in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a move to looking at, well, what's the overall health of the conversation? And freedom of expression is meaningless if other voices are silenced or people are afraid to speak up. So what we are looking at, and what Jack Dorsey has talked a lot about, is what is the health of the public conversation? What are the universal protocols that we need to build to facilitate healthy public conversation? And he has spun up a whole separate piece of work, separate from Twitter, called Blue Sky, which is looking at creating that protocol off which Twitter's like our platforms like Twitter can be built, and new platforms as they emerge, which has as its underpinning that overall universal standard for what a healthy public conversation should look like.
Okay. This week, there was an interesting happen. In fact, Dennis Egan, the CEO of the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board, referenced it last night when he was on the News at One talking about the Gordon Elliott issue. That Gordon Elliott, okay, well, regardless of what anyone thinks about what he did, right, there was a due process situation in place in the horse racing industry. Obviously, people are entitled to their opinion on it and everything, but that Dennis Egan said that really what Gordon Elliott got was like roundly abused all week. And I mean, look, that's one example, but we both know that there are people routinely all the time have their reputations, lives, careers trashed and destroyed, you know, before they even have a chance to react on Twitter.
Yeah. I know that this happens across all platforms. Twitter being an open and public platform, it is much, much more visible. Abuse and harassment have no place on Twitter. As I've said to you, our policies have evolved. They're far more robust within the product itself. We have things like conversation controls. People can mute and block, etc. But I do also think we can have all of those things, and we can continue to play a game of whack-a-mole across the internet, trying to just bat these people down. And this is not an abdication of responsibility. I'm speaking as a citizen as much as the vice president of public policy. We have a problem in our society right now with the levels of anger, the degree to which people get angry about stuff, our inability to allow people to make mistakes and move on from them. That is something that is far more worrying to me as a mother and as an aunt of young people and the kind of world they're going into. Social media I do believe what we're seeing on social media is a symptom of that. That does not take away from our responsibility to deal with it. I am not giving it as an excuse, but I am saying there is a problem. And we actually, as a company, we work with UNESCO, we work with Spun Out here, we've worked with educators here about building programs for young people around digital literacy, digital etiquette, how to behave online. Maybe we need to roll them out for adults as well. But there's definitely a sense, particularly as so much of our life has moved online, that we need to start thinking about, you know, counting to 10 or taking a breath before we type, in the same way that we might take a breath before we, you know, shout at somebody in a queue in the supermarket.
Listen, speaking of someone who probably doesn't always count to 10 before they speak out, in terms of Donald Trump, did Twitter not facilitate the riot that happened on the Capitol Hill in January?
Again, I go back to the fact that Twitter is an open and public platform. I mean, Donald Trump stood on a podium in the middle of Washington and gave a speech that was carried live on multiple networks. Twitter's role in supporting and kind of enabling the democratic process and really enabling voters to connect with leaders and hold leaders to account is incredibly powerful. And as such, world leaders being on Twitter is a critical part of that. However, there does come a point where those world leaders and the value to democracy or the newsworthiness of having them on the platform is outweighed by the potential offline harm. And that's what happened with Donald Trump.
So the reason that Donald Trump was left there for so long was he was newsworthy.
No, there are two elements to it. And we published our policy on world leaders, which was that people actually needed to know what the leader of the free world was thinking, be able to hold him to account for those views. So I think I actually don't like the word newsworthy, because I think it gets bandied around to kind of cover everything from what people need to know to what people want to know.
Sorry, I was just picking up
the
word.
I know I used it, but in my head, it's something about information that is essential to the debate that we need to have, as opposed to something that's going to sell a newspaper.
Yeah, okay. And you think that for that 4 or 5 years before he was eventually censured and then banned, that Donald Trump, people needed to know all that stuff he was saying on Twitter up to then?
Not only do I think they needed to know, but I'm not sure, and this has been the subject of some debate since, that it is entirely on a private company to decide when the elected leader of one of the largest democracies in the world should or should not be on their platform, or should or should not be heard. And also, there's an extent to which Twitter's activity on Trump's activity on Twitter, in some senses, people had more awareness of what Donald Trump was saying on Twitter by tuning into news networks in the US, because every single morning people led with the tweets.
Yeah. You know, so that's interesting. You say you're not sure it should be up to you guys. And it's a thing we hear a lot from big tech, which is like a child that's looking for boundaries. You're kind of saying we want to be regulated more. We want the state to step in, because there's an interesting then other side to the Donald Trump thing, isn't there? Which I think was articulated by people like Ursula von der Leyen, and which is that why is a private company deciding when the president of America or the outgoing president of America should not be heard anymore, and that it's not up to you guys to make decisions about, you know, democratic stuff. Half of America voted for him. Who are you to shut him down?
Yeah, and I have some sympathy with that view. I mean, I sometimes say if this was easy, it would be done already. Right, the complexities of balancing rights of speech against safety and harm are as old as speech and the printing press itself. But when I look at the region, for you know, that comes within my remit. You know, I have everything from Ireland, UK, France, where we're having those debates about how we find that appropriate balance, to needing to have discussions in Russia and Turkey, where there are overt efforts by governments to silence political opponents on our platforms, up to and including blocking the platform. So that's the spectrum that we're looking at.
Yeah, God, it's tricky and complicated, isn't it?
But it's fun.
Yeah,
as a job.
I bet. But come here, all that said, Trump was brilliant at Twitter, wasn't he?
Trump was one of the earliest users of Twitter. Trump was on Twitter like way back before anybody dreamed he might be president. He was a very clever and adept user of the platform.
Mm-hmm. Listen, leaving all that aside for a while, I was looking at a TED talk that you gave back in, it was in 2016.
Yeah, it's
kind of around the area of education.
Life has changed a lot since then.
It has, but in another way, I thought there was kind of a timely message in it, like, which was, I suppose you were saying, one thing you were saying is that, which kids might need to hear right now, is that the Leaving Cert and the subjects you do and what you do in the Leaving Cert is not the be all and end all of everything.
Most definitely not. Like, none of the jobs that I have done existed when I did the Leaving Cert.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And that's the reality of it. So it's more about skills, particularly now, because, you know, there's so much information everywhere, not necessarily knowledge. But, you know, we need to give people skills and competencies around how to analyse, how to engage with people, how to get results. It's not just about knowing stuff.
Yeah, and all that stuff we've just been talking about. The information is there, as you say, but like what you were suggesting in that is that I think you had a priest who kind of encouraged you along. But that critical thinking
Yeah.
Is what we need to give the kids. Yeah. It sometimes strikes me we're educating them for the past still, aren't we?
I think there is an element to that. I have seen changes. I mean, you know, I haven't had experience of the secondary school system yet, but I do have a sister actually who's a secondary school inspector. And I know from talking to her the degree to which the psychology around education has changed in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting then that the jobs. So you started with the question, what are you going to be when you grow up? And of course, you couldn't have imagined any of those things. As you said, you worked for the PSNI, then the Gardaí, and then into Twitter. Into Twitter then was a bit of a leap, was it?
It was and it wasn't. In some senses, I had done police comms, for want of a better word, for a long time. And it's hard. You know, you know the people who end up being the subject of a day's work in a police press office are people who, you know, they're at a difficult time in their lives. You know, something horrible has happened to them, generally speaking. Yeah. And I think you can only do that for so long. And also, we'd had the visit of Queen Elizabeth II and President Obama, and we had opened the AtGarda traffic account to try and get out public information. And it was a huge success. And I just became really excited at the idea that there was this medium for communicating broadly and widely with people with important information. And then Twitter opened its operation in Dublin and we're looking for somebody to do public policy, which gave me the ability to step back a little bit from communications and dealing with media and go back to, I guess, old skills that I had developed around governments and lawmaking, etc.
Okay. Listen, Sinead, a lot of people will know it's been a sad couple of years for you because you lost your husband less than
about
18. He died. You know what? I don't like that phrase either. I was being super polite there.
And it's partly because I have a child, so it's really important that we use the right phrases.
Yes,
but there's also
yes.
an element of we have a sign in the house at home, which is like nothing is lost until mammy can't find it, which is true every day. But it's like he's not lost. He's gone.
Yeah,
he's not.
Okay.
He's not coming back.
Look, I'm so sorry.
No, I'm not. It's not a correction. I just think, and everybody has their individual hang up about words. So other people don't like the word died. It just feels too definite. But for me, I think it's important to say he died.
Yeah. So people will remember your husband. He was Noel Whelan, very well respected barrister, a writer, an activist as well, would you call him?
Yeah, definitely in the last 5 or 6 years, I think his approach to politics changed very much. Like obviously I met him in party politics. We were both involved in Fianna Fáil at the time. I mean, I think we both left Fianna Fáil behind us maybe 15 to 20 years ago. I think his politics in recent years were very much centred around justice, equity, impact. You know, he had this constant sense of that we were both incredibly fortunate to have come from, we worked hard for what we achieved, both in education terms and in career terms. And how do we give back? You know, how can we have an impact on other people's lives? So things like the marriage referendum, the 8th Amendment, but also saving the Senate. And, you know, he had the Kennedy Summer School down in New Ross because he wanted to give something back to New Ross. And he was also somebody that, like, no matter who sent him an email or dropped him a line and said, would you have half an hour and want to talk about my career, or I want to talk about an idea I have, or I have a legal problem, he would always do that. He always had time for people.
Yeah, and he was fantastically, robustly engaged in everything, wasn't he? Ideas, everything. Like, I only knew him from kind of in here, I suppose. But
Everybody knew him from in here. I think he was in here more often than he was at home sometimes on the weekend.
And listen, it was funny as well because people can have certain stereotypes about people who come from a Fianna Fáil, like gene pool or that. But he became then, I suppose, really a kind of a hero of the woke kind of generation, didn't he?
I don't think it's about woke generation. It's about rights.
Yeah.
It's about people being able to be themselves in society and freely and openly. Like, he just had this really highly tuned sense of justice. And, you know, he had actually written about things like civil partnership and gay marriage long before there was a referendum. Like if you go, somebody actually recently went back through columns and kind of went, oh, you know, I thought Noel was a Johnny come lately to this issue, he wasn't. He had actually been writing about it. And some of that came from his legal practice as well, in terms of that sense of people who just weren't getting a fair crack in society.
He was also like, had a brilliant strategic mind in terms of like, he knew that these campaigns like marriage equality was not about preaching to the converted. Like he knew that you needed to talk to, you know, the mammies out there in Offaly or whatever. And he knew how to not maybe oversell the message in a way. Yeah.
Well, he loved campaigns. And again, in the last few years, like it wouldn't matter what party you were, if you came looking for advice about how to run a campaign, like he would just get so excited and go for it. I think probably one of the last party events that he spoke at was a Sinn Féin event before he got sick. So, you know, that was the level of excitement that and also a dedication to politics. And I think our politics is in trouble. You know, there's a disdain and a distrust for politics, which ultimately is not good for us as a society.
He wasn't sick for long, was he?
3 months. Yeah. He was diagnosed in April 2019 and he died in July.
Yeah.
So he was in Vincent's actually for most of that, in St. Anne's Ward, who are absolute heroes. He got home maybe two or three times just for a night or an afternoon across that. We had a lovely afternoon on Dunleary Pier actually at one stage as well. But yeah, it was short and sharp, I guess, in the end.
Yeah. I think we often miss people in a kind of a more, it can be a more muscular way than people think, like, you know, in practical ways.
Yeah.
You must think over the last year of how he would have handled all of this, or what he would have thought. Like.
Yeah, we do talk about that a lot. I mean, there's a sense to which, like, Noel had only been dead 6 months when lockdown came, and I have this sense still of that in some senses it exacerbated the grief, and then in other senses I think it has put it on pause, because I don't know. People talk about going back to a normal life, but I don't know. We hadn't formed that life yet, myself and my son. Yeah. We hadn't figured out what life is without Noel. So I guess we're still working towards that. And I really feel for people who have had loved ones die during COVID, because at least we had a funeral. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And it was incredible. And like, I don't.
And that helps.
It helps
a lot.
It helps hugely. And I just feel for people. And you talk about the muscular thing, like it is still a physical pain. Like there are moments where it is actually a physical pain, where you find yourself just like holding your heart, because it really, really hurts.
Yeah. Listen, your boss, Jack Dorsey, seems like a fascinating character, a philosopher, a wellness guru of sort. Have you met him much?
Yeah, I've met him a good few times. Like, Twitter's actually a very small company. We have this huge brand, but we're a really small company. Like, we employ globally less people than some of our competitors employ just here in Dublin alone.
But so
the impact of that is that, you know, we all nearly have access to leadership. He's been in Dublin three times, I think. And obviously I would see him in San Francisco, and now, you know, we get to see everybody on screens.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, I have met him. He's quite introverted, but he's really, really thoughtful, and he places a huge emphasis on learning. You know, just constantly learning and ensuring that we are a learning organization, because we know we have a lot to learn. We're not done.
The texters feel you have a lot to learn as well. Just a couple. Actually, this is an email, right? Your guest says Twitter is a public platform. It's a private company, public facing. What's the difference between what Twitter does and putting a giant poster along the M50 saying Brendan O'Connor is so-and-so? You would not allow the latter, but you can do it on Twitter at the click of a button.
the issue is consequences. So there are a couple of elements to it. We have policies against abuse and harassment. There are different ways in which those are enforced. Rather than, some of it will be that somebody will be suspended, or rather than have you're either on Twitter or you're not, we also have things like timeouts, trying to change behaviours. But obviously some of this is so egregious that you would not go down that road and you would have a straight suspension. We then have other aspects of behaviour on Twitter, which are bad behaviour, which may not breach the rules or are not illegal, where we downrank them. So in some senses, so when I see something directed at me on Twitter, I will look and I'll say, OK, so who is this person? How many followers do they have? And then I think about, if I just ignore them, they're still just talking to their 5 followers. Whereas if I engage with them or if I retweet it and say this terrible thing is happening on Twitter, well, now I've introduced that person to all of my followers. So there's an extent to which a lot of the material, yes, needs to be actioned, needs to be deleted, and the users need to be off the platform. But then there is another level of content that nobody will actually ever see if we don't amplify it. And that's the way the internet generally is going, because this sense of trying to remove content from the internet is like it's just this ever filling hole that we're never actually going to dig ourselves out to. So that's why things like algorithmic transparency and looking at, OK, what kind of content is being pushed into people's feed? Is it the right content, and what shouldn't be getting amplified? So there's an extent to which, I guess you could say, people do have a right to say things, but they don't always have a right to be heard.
Yeah. Look, it's going to be it's an amazing job you have, and it's going to be challenging and fascinating, I think, for all of us to see how all this pans out over the next 10 years or whatever, this massive experiment. Listen, going back to Noel, so many nice texts about you and about Noel, but one person from Wexford: what a great strong lady, a formidable force, just like her Colossus late husband Noel Whelan, a proud and very much missed Wexford man. Someone else says a very nice thing: I don't know if you can miss a stranger, but I miss Noel Whelan. That's Mary Rose Tobin. Yeah, all right, resonates. Listen, Sinead McSweeney, Managing Director of Twitter Ireland and Vice President of Public Policy in Europe, Middle East, and not forgetting Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.